This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation this week. I'm Sedge Thompson. The cold, desolate lands of the North hold a special attraction for my guest, Lawrence Millman, who heads there whenever he can. He's visited Greenland 8 times, Iceland 7, and Labrador 5. During his latest journey, he planned his itinerary by following a course first charted by the Vikings from Norway to Newfoundland 10 centuries ago. Millman's new book, Last Places, tells of his wanderings through the North, marooned with a village of skeletons in Greenland, swimming in a sulfuric, greenish, volcanic mud in the midst of a blizzard, battling giant seabirds in the Shetland Islands. This is Lawrence Millman's 7th book. He's also written about his travels to Ireland in Our Like Will Not Be There Again, and his forthcoming book is an account of his travels to the Ecuadorian Amazon. I ask Lawrence Millman why he chose the route he took across the North Atlantic.
I've long been a devotee of the North, and as my friends seem always to go to the lands of the carcinogenic sun to the south, I always seem to head up north where there's less sun and where I find myself, extremely happy. And I had traveled to most places in the north, and I decided I would go on a prolonged journey in which I would try to link them together, find some way in which cultures rubbed off of each other. And it seemed to me that the best way to do this was to follow the Viking sea route from the Old World to the New World. And I set sail in a passenger ferry called the Nerona from Bergen, Norway, and went to the Shetlands, the Faroes, Iceland, Greenland, Labrador, Newfoundland, and ended up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, some of those places are not obviously Viking sites. I felt that, as with any itinerary, that I could break out of it and go my own way. I mean, one of the purposes of an itinerary is to, in fact, destroy it rather than to pursue something very, very rigidly.
How fluent are you in the languages of Iceland and Greenland?
Well, in Iceland, I learned Icelandic. I spent a year teaching at the University of Iceland in Reykjavik. And I learned enough Icelandic to get by. But Icelanders are so multitudinously fluent themselves that they could have communicated with me in English or Danish or, in many cases, French, and in certain cases, various Eastern European languages, since a lot of Icelanders in the 50s and 60s went to school in Budapest and Prague and so on. So I wouldn't have needed to have learned much Icelandic. I found that the language more or less a challenge, which is why I set out to learn it. In Greenland, it's a bit different. There are not many people who speak English. And I found that in order to survive, really, I had to learn some Greenlandic. And what I learned, really, at the very outset were words that had to do with food. Usually it's words that pertain to food that come to me first, in that I arrive in a place and, not surprisingly, get quite hungry. So I learn what the word for whale is, and they bring me a whale.
What is the word for whale? Could you give us some examples of some
Sildepiskur. Actually, that's my favorite kind of whale. I'm talking about the food rather than, let's say, the marine mammal. It's jerked whale meat in the Greenlandic fashion, which is a little like beef jerky. It's been hung up to dry. The winds buffet it, the rains assault it, blizzards overpower it, and after a while it has this wonderful quality. I mean, it's not just a meat. It's a combination of meat and the weather, and perhaps it gives a kind of resonance of the Northlands as well. I wish I had some right now, in fact. Another food I especially like is halkarv, which is fermented Icelandic shark's meat. That's buried in the ground in the gravel pit for up to about 6 months and then hung up to dry, again buffeted by all the elements. And it has a kind of gnarled, desiccated quality. In fact, I got a big piece of it when I was hitchhiking in Iceland some years ago. The piece was sticking out of my rucksack. It was picked up by this Englishman. Now, of course, the hawkart does have a bit of a smell. And I was picked up by this Englishman who kept looking over at me oddly and looking at the rucksack that was in the back seat of his car. And he finally looked at me and said, "My God, man, have you robbed a graveyard?" given the nature of the way the piece of shark's meat looked and smelled, I could easily appreciate his question.
My guest is travel writer Lawrence Millman. His new book, Last Places, tells of his trip to retrace an ancient Viking route from Norway to Newfoundland. You devote a couple of pages at the end of your book to acknowledgments, including the Guggenheim Foundation for support in writing the book, but also to transport agencies and to different kinds of suppliers. And it reads almost like credits for a traditional exploration, an expedition. And I'm wondering if you had different benefactors for this trip.
Well, I find that to do the sort of thing I do with the kind of impecunious lifestyle I seem to lead, I do need freebies. And I have made a point over the years where friends of mine might go out and make friends with fellow writers. I tend to make friends with public relations people, bush pilots, and their ilk, because I know that at some point they'll be of use in my own wanderings.
One of the people who thank is somebody who included you on a Greenland cruise, and you say all you could offer in return for the passengers was an evening of scatological folktales. And it seems kind of a nice trade. You get help with a journey, and you tell some travel stories that kind of...
Well, these were actually folktales. I mean, once upon a time, I traveled in Greenland and the Arctic collecting Inuit myths and folktales, which later appeared in a book called A Kayak Full of Ghosts. And I'll tell you actually how that all began. I had flown from Iceland to the east coast of Greenland with a friend who was a bush pilot, who was visiting a girlfriend of his in the small East Greenland village of Kulisuk. And on one of the occasions when he was visiting her, I was walking around the village taking photographs of sled dogs and some of the shacks and a couple of kids eating Eskimo pies, and that's what they're called, and they really like Eskimo pies in Greenland. And I backed up to get a panoramic picture of the village, and I toppled down an icy incline into a Maassluk fjord through the ice. This was November, and it was a startling experience, to say the least. I blacked out, and the next thing I knew, two local fellows had covered me in blanket and were taking me to the Kulisuk Infirmary. And meanwhile, I was laid up there for a few days, and I found that in the next bed there was this elderly fellow who was drying out, so to speak, in a different way than I was drying out. He had probably had, during the course of a weekend, maybe 72 or to 100 bottles of Carlsberg Lager, and was now much the worse for wear. We got to chatting in a mixture of several languages. I was communicating a little bit in Icelandic, which is enough like Danish that he could understand me. And I knew a bit of Greenlandic at that time. And he started telling me these incredible folk tales, including one about a relation of his who, during the winters of 1883-84, when winters were stuck together in the Greenlandic phrase, as he put it, like, quote, copulating dogs, this woman, this relation named Kaligasak, had eaten three generations of her own family, waiting until they were dead, of course. And he told story after story, and I had been familiar with Inuit stories before. These were real different. I realized that the stories that had appeared in most anthologies were cleaned up a bit. They were cleaned up for the benefit of polite Anglo kids, whereas the real thing was infinitely more earthy, more scatological, as you might say, than what I had read. And I made a vow to myself that I would wander the Arctic and collect as many of these stories as I need to collect to get an anthology together. And that's what I did. And as for this trip that you mentioned, I was brought along as a kind of ombudsman between the passengers and the people on shore. And I got the free trip, and what I did was one of the evenings I regaled the passengers with some of the stories that I had collected in, primarily in East Greenland.
And so you yourself have become kind of a Greenlandic storyteller.
Well, I sort of have. Yeah, I sort of have. I mean, obviously these stories are dying out, like most folk tales. And I think one reason they're dying out is not what you might think. I mean, not that you know the storytellers are dying out. They're really not. It's that the young people seem less interested. I mean, what you find in Greenland, for example, is that all the young people are learning about computer technology. They're studying computers in schools, and they may have even computers at home, even though they don't have any running water. And I mean, I find that too great an admiration for computers tends to be very damaging to the memory. One consigns one's own memory over to what's called a kwasiosut, a little artificial brain in Greenland. Then when you get a story told, for the life of you, you can't remember it. That's what I found in Greenland. I mean, the old people who were sort of pre-computer age knew the stories and they would tell them, but it was the shortened form of memory that the young people had which prevented them from really realizing the stories, appreciating them, and finally remembering them.
I was struck by the amount of alcohol that's consumed in the countries of Greenland and Iceland. You describe people, carrying around cases of beer with them, just as a way we might drink a cup of coffee. I wonder what effect you saw on the people of Greenland and Iceland from all this alcohol.
The effect, it's really different. I think in Greenland from Iceland. I mean, Iceland is a white, essentially European culture where people, owing to runaway inflation, have to hold down two or three full-time jobs. And drinking tends more or less to be a weekend activity, and they really get knackered. But somehow, miraculously, they're ready for work on Monday morning. In Greenland and Labrador, it's a little bit different. You have people deprived of their traditions for one reason or another, the last link with those traditions being their right to hunt, which various organizations like Greenpeace are trying to deprive them of. And they've got a lot of time on their hands. They've also been deprived of their ancient religion. And I've often had the theory that one reason they drink so much is that, they are trying to get back in touch with the ecstatic, you know, the kind of rarefied realm they had before white man came, in which all things were holy and all things natural, in which gods lived inside rocks and trees and even lemming droppings on the trail, where everything was just sort of energized and animate. I think one of the most perverse examples of it occurs in Labrador, where the Innu, who are a native group in Labrador, a group of Indians, the young kids tend to have what's called dynamite parties. And they'll get drunk, and then one fellow, a little bit more brave than the others, will bury himself in the ground, and there'll be a stick of dynamite placed in the ground not too far from him, let's say 5 or 10 feet away. And it will be ignited, and it'll go off, and it'll explode, and out he'll come flying from the ground and be catapulted, quite a distance, if he lives. Well, he'll be catapulted if he lives and if he doesn't. But there have been many instances of kids blowing themselves to smithereens of doing this. It's sort of like, you kind of think that it has something to do with traditions lost. I mean, after all, in the old days, they did tend to get elevated, as it were, by natural phenomenon. Now they don't. And so they are forced to elevate themselves artificially.
This also seems to be a way of destroying their culture simultaneously.
Yeah, well, and their lives, too, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer Lawrence Millman. I was interested to read your references to what it was you were reading when you were in the midst the barren, glacier-swept landscape. You'd be in your tent. It'd be perhaps snowing outside or very cold, and you'd be reading a Georges Simenon mystery, set obviously in an arrondissement in Paris. And it seemed like this wonderful discontinuity, you seeking out the rural isolation while reading an urban mystery novel.
Well, I must say that Simenon novels are very good for backcountry trekkers because they're very small and you can stick them into, you know, you can stick them between the sweat socks and the thermal underwear, or you can find some little niche in your rucksack that hasn't yet been filled, and you can bend the book back and shove it in. It's much easier to carry around, 5 or 6 Simenons than maybe one Tolstoy.
That's an interesting way of choosing your literature for the field.
Right. I happen to like Simenon very much, too. And when you asked me that question earlier about what I brought along, and I mentioned all the essentially foul-weather gear, I neglected to mention what I think of as yet another example of foul-weather gear, which are books. I mean, invariably, one tends to be stranded, tent-bound, rained upon, and removed from normal human communication during the course of one's wanderings in the North. And one of the best companions that you can have in such circumstances is a book. And I found invariably, there was one time when I was stuck in East Greenland with a hunter, and it was raining, sleeting. I mean, every type of possible foulness from the sky was coming down on us. And fortunately, I had among my provisions about 6 or 7 books of different types, including Suetonius. And I was reading there in the remote fjordlands of East Greenland, The Lives of the 12 Caesars. I was quite delighted, to say the least.
You keep as pets some giant Madagascar hissing cockroaches?
Yes.
Living?
Oh, they're living. Yes, they're living and very, very active.
Where did you collect them, in Madagascar?
No, I got them from Harvard, as a matter of fact. A friend of mine is a professor of insect studies there, and he had his freshman class dissect a bunch of these. I saved them from the surgical knife, and I have now about 8. Giant Madagascar hissing cockroaches and 5 giant Suriname non-hissing cockroaches. And they're wonderful creatures. They're really very, very beautiful. They have this quality of having survived intact from the Carboniferous period without any changes, as indeed they have. But another reason I have them, I spend a lot of time traveling, a lot of time away from home. And if I had any other kind of pet, I would have to kennel, billet, or find some place for that pet to be removed while I was away. But the nice thing about these cockroaches is they're just as happy not to have me around as they are to have me around. They can survive quite a long period of time. I'm told upwards of a year without water or food. I mean, obviously, by the end of that time, they'll be a little bit emaciated, but they'll still be alive.
Do these cockroaches make an audible hissing sound?
Well, they make an audible hissing noise. And in fact, they do it on several occasions, I've discovered. They tend to do it when they're about ready to mate. They tend to do it when you pick them up and they don't want to be picked up. But I've also found that atonal music played on the radio causes them to hiss. And, you know, you may think that's a joke, but it's absolutely true. I mean, any kind of loud, rasping noise usually causes them to hiss. And what I've concluded, it's not so much that they tend to be irritated by it, but they're listening to something by Schoenberg, for example, and they think Schoenberg is a fellow giant Madagascar hissing cockroach. And they hiss in response.
You were born in Kansas City. Do you feel any connection with the Midland of America, or do you find that you have to travel to these far-flung, exotic, barren places for your satisfactions?
Well, I don't feel much connection, really. I mean, I think that it's always nice for a travel writer to come from a place that he doesn't particularly like and thus have an adversary relationship to that place because he will always in his mind be trying to get away from it and seek out new and even more exotic climes. I mean, I think that that's my case, and I think that in the case of Paul Theroux, he's forever trying to escape from Medford, Massachusetts. I don't know if you've ever been to Medford, but if I were to choose between Medford and, let's say, Kansas City, I probably would choose neither.
You have honored places such as Greenland and Iceland because of their isolation and the fact they seem relatively untouched by outside influences. Do you also fear that a travel book might entice people to visit Iceland and Greenland?
Well, I don't think my book will. I don't think I've made those places attractive enough to start a tourist stampede. I mean, who wants to go to a place, for example, like the Faroes, where you'll be seeing harbors filled up with whale's blood, or places like Greenland where, try as you might, you're not going to even find the remotest semblance of a cucumber or a carrot. And I think most people would just be happy to stay at home and read about it. I'm not too worried that they're going to be spoiled by travel writing.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and being with us on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, Sedge. Let me leave you with one parting word in Labrador Inuit. Umayalutungetugavit asasak.
Which means?
I hope a sea monster doesn't get you, my friend.
Well, and to you, safe journey.
Thank you.
Lawrence Millman's new book is Last Places, A Journey in the North. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.